So I'm joined on the line by Henry Widdus, who was on our show, gosh, must be a couple of months ago now, Henry. You were talking about going into supermarkets for your paper and just seeing the extent to which or not that the masks were being enforced. But I know that you're quite concerned about the way that journalists particularly are being affected by this. Can you just introduce yourself and tell us a bit about why the interest in journalism as a whole, rather than just doing this as a reporter?
My name's Henry Widdus. I'm a JPI Media page manager in the Northwest, but I'm also the chairman of the Northwest Lancashire branch of the National Union of Journalists. And since March, I've been sort of looking to get a counter argument to the overwhelming narrative that COVID is extremely deadly, and I just wanted to get a bit of balance. And back in April, I started looking at the Off Guardian website, and I did a sort of an opinion piece in the paper, which I thought might turn a few heads and get some of my colleagues questioning about what was really going on. Sort of quoting all sorts of scientific people who like Professor Gupta, from Oxford University. I even referenced her back in April. Of course, she's in the news at the moment, front page of the Daily Mail today, I think, setting up a petition with other epidemiologists to say that lockdown's devastating. But anyway, so I referenced her back then, saying that the scaremongering from Professor Propaganda Neil Ferguson could be orders of magnitude out. Anyway, since April, nothing's happened. The overwhelming narrative has continued. Most of my colleagues are on board with that. I'm not, so I'm sticking out like a sore thumb. As a result, I've also had to step down because I didn't want to split in the chapel that I represented for JPI Media. There's a split between those who were sort of anti-lockdown or lockdown questioning and those who were very supportive of lockdown. So I thought, with me being the representative for them, I was going to divide the chapel and maybe we would lose uni membership. So I've stepped down from there. But Ben Butler, who's also online with us, have decided to set up a group of journalists who are willing to question lockdown. We'll do so in the paper, but we'll just do so in newsrooms and over Zoom chats. And just off the cuff, we called it Hold Authority to Account, which has the acronym HATA. And I just had an idea. If it takes off, we'll have to have T-shirts. Hat will do nicely.
Okay, so Ben, could you introduce yourself? Tell us a bit about why you thought it was worthwhile joining such a group.
Yes, I'm Ben Butler. I work as a reporter for JPI Media Northwest. And I felt it was important to set up this group because I feel that the mainstream media coverage and also the local media coverage is far too heavily skewed in terms of the government line, and that we're not hearing those alternative voices from other scientists that are challenging the whole agenda around lockdowns and restrictions and surrounding the threat of the virus. I feel like the job of the media is to challenge authority, not to be the mouthpieces for the government. If we wanted to do that, we'd be in North Korea or China. So I felt it was really important to set up the group to act as a focal point for journalists to share mainstream media coverage of the COVID-19 crisis. The group's there to challenge it, but it's also there for people of all views, including those sceptical of a cause. We don't want it to be a kind of conspiracy theory type group. But we just want to provide some balance to a certain narrative that's conveyed in the mainstream media that COVID is a deadly threat to us all and that these restrictions are justified when in reality they're not.
Well, hang on, because, the government, in a way, they have the medical experts there, Ben, and you're not a medical expert, you're a journalist. I mean, they are far better equipped to determine what the threat is than you are, surely.
I openly admit I'm not a scientist, but I have worked as a health reporter in my previous job at the Lancashire Telegraph, and I've also read alternative views from scientists such as Sinetra Gupta at Oxford University, Carl Hennigan also at Oxford University, Professor Carol Sikora, and all these scientists are saying that that this lockdown wasn't necessary and that there is an alternative path.
Well, that's true. I mean, for example, we've had Dolores Cahill, who was one of the most respected epidemiologists in Europe. She's been extremely outspoken about it. She's been going to rallies in Trafalgar Square and goodness knows what, speaking about it. So why is it that those scientists that challenge the government have not been getting a view?
I just think that it's because it doesn't fit in with the government's own agenda. From what I was reading, up until about March the 12th, the government were following the herd immunity approach of Sweden. But then they changed course when Professor Propaganda Ferguson, as Henry calls him, come in and we all of a sudden went down the lockdown line, even though there was no evidence to suggest that that makes any difference whatsoever. And I think we're starting to see the tide turn now. We've seen the front page in the Daily Mail today, 4,000 medical experts and doctors calling for a change in direction away from lockdowns to protecting the elderly and the vulnerable and letting everyone else get on with their lives. And that's something that I, from the very start, have felt we should have done in the same way that Sweden have done and done it to a lot of success. They've actually got a lower death rate than the likes of lockdown Spain and lockdown UK. So I think there should be a lot more coverage in the media of that and these alternative voices from scientists, because there just isn't enough of it nationally or locally.
No, it's become very unbalanced. I think you're absolutely right. But look, Henry, what do you think I'll ask you the same question I asked Ben. Why is it, do you think, that only certain experts that back the government have been getting airtime? It does look as if there's actually a specific programme of censorship. I mean, I had a look at the Ofcom guidelines, which were put out, this is back in March, I think it was the 26th of March, which talk about health claims and medical advice which is harmful, which is put out by radio stations covered by Ofcom and TV channels, will be punished by Ofcom with sanctions. But of course, now looking back on it, the medical advice by the government to remove people from hospitals and put them into care homes without being tested has possibly killed tens of thousands of people. And that, of course, was peddled by all of the TV channels and the newspapers at the time pretty much uncritically. So bizarrely, they all should have been sanctioned by Ofcom for not criticising what the government was doing, which was giving bad health advice. But so what's your take on why the coverage has been so one-sided?
To put it simply, I would say you just follow the money and ask who benefits. And as an example of that, there's the SAGE group of the government, which is the Scientific Advisory Group for Emergencies. That's co-chaired by Sir Patrick Vallance, who's the sort of one of the lead doctors advising the government, and he's just recently been revealed to have £600,000 worth of shares in GlaxoSmithKline. And there's also another worrying aspect of the SAGE group is I think we talked about this last time briefly, is the Spy B subgroup, which is that stands for the Scientific Pandemic Influenza Group on Behaviour and Communication, and that sort of specialises in manipulating the population to comply and be coerced to obey these lockdown measures, which, as Ben was saying, are extreme and unnecessary. So, you know, there's the manipulation line of, you know, censoring the doctors or experts who have an alternative view, and B, propaganda to ensure that most people comply, and even if they don't believe it.
You know, there was legal action, wasn't there, back, I think it was in April or May, to force SAGE to publish their minutes, which you would have thought that this is not a question of national security. So, you know, actually publishing the SAGE minutes should be done normally, but it wasn't, and they had to force them to do it. But we're now in the situation where local authorities, in conjunction with government, are making some of these decisions. Still, none of the evidence behind any of these lockdowns is being published, so it can't be scrutinised. What does that mean, Ben, do you think, for journalists who are trying to explain to the public why something has been decided when they're not allowed to know what the evidence is behind decisions?
that thing, they're just unable to do the jobs properly. The job of a journalist is to hold authority to account, and we're unable to do that because of things like this. And at the end of the day, we live in a democratic country where we've got a free press. And if I wanted to go to North Korea or China, I would. And that's increasingly how it's feeling with the way that this is going.
Talking about money, I think both of you have mentioned that to a certain extent. Certainly you did, Henry. People making money out of things. One of the people who's been quite outspoken about this for a long, long time, the idea of the vaccine companies having too much power in the lobbies. Apparently, the big pharmaceutical industries, otherwise known as Big Pharma, have got more lobbying clout even than the arms companies. And when you look at the arms sales to Yemen and Saudi Arabia, well, to Saudi Arabia, to kill the Yemeni people, which are going into their tens of billions, you would think that the arms industry had a pretty powerful lobby. But apparently, Big Pharma is even more powerful. The producer of the documentary Vaxxed, which was due to play at the Sundance Film Festival a few years ago, about some of the dangers of vaccines, and we're not saying that you should never take a vaccine, but there are certainly dangers associated with these things that people need to know about so they can make a conscious choice when they decide whether or not to have them. There's this principle, basic principle, which is called informed consent, where a doctor advises you, I think this is the best thing for you to do, and then you decide for yourself whether you want to take that treatment or not. But anyway, Del Bigtree actually says, he said before all of this, this was, I believe, around about December last year or January 2020, that the pharmaceutical industry wanted to turn the vaccine business from a $50 billion a year business into a $1 trillion a year business in one fell swoop. And this is actually what they seem to be achieving with this whole COVID-19 program. So just as by way of a little break, let's have a listen now to this speech by Del Bigtree to one of the committees of Congress about 9 or 10 months ago, before the COVID-19 outbreak.
People need to know. Not a single childhood vaccine has ever been tested against an inert placebo. They never admitted that until we challenged them on it. In that meeting, we said we cannot find any double-blind inert placebo study for a single one of the 16 childhood vaccines that we give our children. Are they not being done, or are you not showing them? Are we looking at the wrong websites? Because we've read every single scientific piece of information from our government and from the manufacturers. At first, one of the scientists said, oh, we do double-blind experiments. They're just in early trial phases. And we said, fine, we're sitting at the National Institute of Health. Please bring those in right now, because they would be here. They couldn't provide that. And then Tony Fauci, head of infectious disease, said, we don't do double-blind experiments with placebos because it would be unethical. So our medical establishment has decided that it's unethical to have a placebo group, and therefore not a single childhood vaccine has ever established a safety control. We don't know if they're safe. There's no way to say they're safe. Essentially, we've decided in this country and around the world that it's more ethical to give a product that's never been through a safety study to every child in the country. Now what they'll say is, well, we've been running it for a very long time and it's proven to be safe. Well, really, we have the sickest generation of children this country has ever seen. We have seen the largest decline in public health in history. We have gone from 12.8% chronic illness, so neurological or autoimmune diseases in the 1980s, before we took liability away, when we were getting 10 vaccines. Then we took liability away from the industry. They could no longer be sued if their products injured anyone. And now, in 2019, we're giving 72 vaccines, and our chronic illness rate in our children is 54%. We've gone from 12 to 54% chronic illness. That means neurological disorders in 1 in 6 of our children. 1 in 7 has a speech delay. 1 in 4 is leaving elementary school on a drug they're going to be on the rest of their lives. The point being, this is the greatest crash in public health we've ever seen. We have more babies dying on the first day of life than every other industrialized nation combined. These are all facts. I can back them up. I'll show a lot of them are cited here. We have more babies dying in the first year of life than the 20 other richest nations in the world. And we're now reporting we're 70% more likely to die before reaching 18 in America than the 20 other richest nations. What is the reason for this? Well, there's two things that I think people say, well, you're saying vaccines are doing all of that. We now have science that's happening all over the world that's showing how vaccines are definitely contributing to the problem. But here's the point. Should we be listening to health departments? Should we be making laws based on recommendations from a health department that has overseen the greatest decline in public health in world history? I think that we really need to look twice. And I would urge any politician to say, I want to see the science from the other side. They keep saying there's thousands of studies that show that vaccines don't cause autism. We've read them. They're not there. Those science studies do not exist. They are not there. There are 14 total studies looking at autism, and half of them are on the MMR vaccine and the other on thimerosal. When they say vaccines, plural, do not cause autism, they have only looked at one vaccine out of 16 vaccines. Most parents are complaining that the DTaP vaccine causes autism, and the Institute of Medicine looked into it, and you know what they found? Not a single study has ever looked at the comparison of autism and the DTaP vaccine. They said, we can neither confirm nor deny whether the DTaP vaccine causes autism, and that's what's cited by the CDC. That study is what they cite when they say vaccines, plural, do not cause autism. That's a fraud. That's a fraud being perpetrated by the CDC. And so the warning that I would be giving from your team to everyone else is, you can be the first Nazi in, and throughout history, when we start book burning, when we start censoring speech, when we start using bullying tactics to move society instead of information and science, we know we're coming to our end. And we don't want to see the government fail. We do not want to see oppression. And by the way, this oppression, laws like this, taking away this exemption, is making our movement explode. Mm-hmm. It is exploding. Mm-hmm. And measles is exploding, because what would you do if you were told you were going to be quarantined from being able to be in a synagogue on Passover? You'd say, let's go ahead and get the measles out of the way right now so that we can never be quarantined again. They are causing what they call an epidemic. How do you call something an epidemic when everyone in it is trying to get the measles? That's what's happening in New York. No one's running from it. This is not Ebola.
No, 5,000
people have to go get your vaccine this week. You're going to say, hold on a second, I've been healthy for 15 years without a vaccine, and so is every adult in this country. So they're going to remove the exemptions before they bring the adult mandate. The pharmaceutical industry isn't the number one most powerful lobby in Washington, outspending oil and gas simply because they want to waste time in Washington. They have one product, the vaccine industry, that cannot be sued, doesn't have to go through safety studies. So there's no cost on this product. There's no risk on this product. We have 72 vaccines now. 270 have been approved, and thousands are in trials as we speak. Mm-hmm. The future of this industry is vaccines, and every politician they can buy to force more vaccines into the population, they're going to make money. But the moment the adult mandate comes, I assure you, pharma's not fighting for the 2% of the unvaccinated kids. They want 320, 40 million Americans, wherever we're at right now, indentured to a program that will turn the pharmaceutical industry from a billion-dollar industry, $50 billion they're making from vaccines right now, into a trillion-dollar industry overnight. That is what is taking place, and it is people like you and great politicians that are protecting us right now, as they should, from one of the most dangerous industries that has paid out over $30 billion in damages for having killed us with products they knew were dangerous.
So that was the producer of the documentary Vaxxed in the United States, featuring the discredited Dr. Andrew Wakefield, amongst others. He was speaking there to one of the congressional committees charged with overseeing the pharmaceutical industry in the United States. Amazing to hear, Henry, that the Big Pharma has got this ambition, or it did have the end of last year, to go from a $50 billion to a $1 trillion industry. Now, let's just think about that in terms of 20 times. Any industry that can press a button and increase its turnover by 20 is going to make quite a lot of money for its shareholders.
Yeah, it is absolutely shocking how much of a money spent in vaccines are. And I was completely clueless about vaccines until this was really going on, and as I started looking into it, and it is quite shocking. And I may even have asthma because of a vaccine I had when I was 8 years old. I was like, I had these sort of various school vaccines. And then a few months later, I developed asthma. And, I've never, ever made a connection between the two in my whole life. Suddenly, I've been reading all reports of what vaccines can cause. So, I think there's informed consent is the key here. And I really think we're quite possibly sleepwalking into a world where informed consent goes on the back burner. So that's why another reason why we've set up this group, so we can just hold authorities to account, keep questioning, keep asking the uncomfortable questions, encourage lots of other journalists to join up, and then we're hoping to maybe even release an official statement to journalistic publications like Hold the Front Page to state there's three things that I would hope that the other members agree with, and that is censorship on the mainstream, on global media platforms like Facebook, YouTube and Twitter, where like that Dolores, that vaccine expert you mentioned, she's like censored left, right and center.
She is, yeah.
So that's just chucking informed consent out the window when people can't even see the counter argument on vaccines. And then the other argument that, as Ben's mentioned, is it's just being quite unbalanced, the questioning of lockdown and COVID. It's all around, you know, within the narrow parameters of, okay, yeah, COVID's extremely deadly, so we should have locked down earlier, we should have had more PPE. There's very, very little questioning of, hang on, this isn't quite so deadly as we're being told, and the statistics show that. So, yeah, that's the second one. And then the third one that I wanted to raise, but I'm not sure all members would agree, is that just, you know, I haven't even got a TV licence, but when I go to my girlfriend's, I'm subjected to this morning TV, which is quite interesting to see the counter argument. And, you know, even like to Spotify and, you know, every media outlet is, and radio, it's just you're pumped with adverts from the cabinet office, and it's paid by the taxpayer.
Well,
and to me, it's propaganda.
What I would say about that is that on talk radio, you're getting quite a different one. But talk radio, for some bizarre reason, has been booted off, or have decided to go off of DAB, and they're now on DAB Plus. So you have to get a special DAB Plus radio in order to listen to talk radio now. With Julia Hartley Brewer, Mike Graham, and people like that on there.
I could invite them on the group, actually. They might be willing to join.
Yeah, but isn't it strange how suddenly they're pushed onto a new type of digital radio that hardly anybody has got a digital radio receiver that can even pick it up? This DAB Plus stuff, you know, is something which is actually very inaccessible. Most people are having to listen to that via the internet. So anyway, back to you, Ben. Threat and the restrictions, how do you think that that's been balanced, and what do you think the threat really is?
I don't think the threat is anything like how it's being portrayed to be. I think the way we've got to look at it is health, education, employment, finances and social and mental well-being of the population is effectively being destroyed for this illusory goal of stopping the spread of a coronavirus that I believe is essentially harmless to 99% of the population and lethal almost exclusively to the elderly with serious underlying medical conditions. And I just feel that the restrictions in light of the threat of the virus are just totally unjustified. And the reason why we've seen an increase in cases recently is because we've had more testing, and we've got the whole issue around the dubious polymerase chain reaction, which is actually harmless fragments of the virus that aren't actually cases of it. And I just feel that the whole approach to it is completely skewed. There's so much scaremongering in the media from the mainstream scientists and the government. Obviously, we saw Witty and Balance with the 50,000 cases by mid-October. And looking at the evidence, there's no evidence that that's going to happen. They were saying 200 deaths by October. Again, that's not going to happen. So the whole debate around it is completely skewed in one direction, and the restrictions that we've seen are completely disproportionate to the actual threat of the virus.
Have you seen that any of your editors or, you know, subs and people like this, you know, actually at the coalface, have taken any of this on board?
I don't think nationally and locally the media have done enough to challenge the narrative by the government that's being peddled out, and we're not hearing those views from the alternative scientists and the arguments against lockdowns and restrictions. All we're hearing is how COVID is a very deadly virus and that we need these restrictions to beat it. Although in reality, will we actually ever get rid of it, even if a vaccine comes along the chances are it's still going to be there, like it is with flu. So I think we just got to learn to live with it, and I just don't think that any of this has been reflected in the national or the local media coverage.
We have a bit of a break and have a listen to some music. And as I mentioned, Del Bigtree there, the US documentary producer, and we heard a bit from him, that we should hear a song which appears, I mean, this is really only my conspiracy theory, if you want, a bit of guesswork, by Ian Brown, the frontman from the Stone Roses.
We don't need no stinking badges.
A false vaccine, like a bad dream, a plan chip us all to have complete control, the land, the sky, our soul.
So that was Little Seed, Big Tree. My conspiracy theory is it's dedicated to Del Big Tree, who's one of the, most respected anti-pharmaceutical industry child protection documentary makers in the United States, and the singer's Ian Brown from the Stone Roses. And joining me is Henry Widdus and Ben Butler, both from journalists from up north. Look, can I just ask you first, Ben, what about working? Because how has the working conditions for journalists changed?
It's been a complete change. We've gone from being office-based and going to court and council meetings and getting out and about in the public to working at home remotely. I'm working in Gorton at the moment, which is some 45 minutes away from where my work is based. And the remote working has been a real challenge in terms of staying in contact with your contacts and in just getting out and meeting people and doing your job. It's heavily restricted. You can't go to court the same, to council. They are doing things on streams and stuff, but it's just not the same. So there are a lot of real challenges, and the practicalities for a journalist to work from home, it's just not realistic. It's not like an office job. It's one of them jobs where you do need to be out and about and in the office, and we're just not able to do that at the moment.
Well, I mean, the annoying thing is, of course, that by actually outsourcing people to their home address, it suddenly becomes much easier for these big media companies to say, well, actually, I'm sorry, we're making you redundant and we're bringing in people who are doing your job from abroad, maybe from India or somewhere like that. I mean, is there any potential for that, do you think?
Well, that's what worries me, that the longer that we work from home and work remotely, the longer that these restrictions go on, the bigger the threat to our jobs. We're obviously seeing people in all kinds of different industries being made redundant, and you do fear that the same thing could happen with journalism.
But like, Ben, you know, the newspaper industries, particularly the regional and local newspapers, have been saying for many years that there is a crisis of survival there, that they may not survive. So maybe this, you know, sort of getting rid of offices, you know, slimming down might actually enable you to keep your job.
That is a good counter argument, and you are right to say that if we get rid of the offices, then you'd save money in that sense. But I just think if you go to a system of remote working, it will give them an excuse to make job cuts and to make redundancies, and like you've said, to maybe have someone globally doing something, and that journalism on the ground in the town will be gone, and that's a big chunk of democracy that's just disappeared. And I do want to bring in the union as well, the National Union of Journalists. I don't think as a union they've done anywhere near enough to challenge these restrictions, to question them and to stand up for our jobs, because ultimately the longer these restrictions go on, the longer that we work remotely from home, the more likely we are to face the prospect of redundancy. And I think that the union could have done a lot more.
Yeah, well, the union is probably, fair to say, it's only as good as its members, Ben. So have you been lobbying the union? What have you been trying to get them to do?
I've attended a number of meetings, and I've got across my points of view, and I know Henry has as well. And but there's only so much you can do. The majority of the members seem to be generally in favour of the restrictions, and there's only so much.
It's amazing, isn't it? Because they may end up losing their jobs as a result. Henry, what do you make of the working conditions? Have things changed for you?
Well, I was already working from home a couple of days a week, so it wasn't as much of a shock to the system. And because I'm sort of like a page manager, I'm just working on InDesign, sort of, you know, laying out pages, doing headlines and so on. So it's not been that much of a change for me. And the one thing I do miss, and the one thing that I think Ben hit on, it's a very key point that journalism should really be an office-based job, because you've got new recruits coming through, and the way they learn is sitting next to a senior reporter, learn the ropes, you know, learn the tricks of the trade, if you like, and now they're just being left out in a lurch, you know, with no sort of physical contact, and you know, there's only so much you can communicate from a Zoom meeting, and more often than not, I've just found that we just communicate via emails, and you don't learn as much. And as you know, like, you have sort of a conversation face to face, you can reach a conclusion and get somewhere much, much quicker than you can if you're just exchanging emails back and forth.
Well, no, you're right, but, and I know you are really concerned as well about the way that the care homes I mentioned earlier, but that whole angle to this story has been almost a national scandal, bigger than the COVID itself, because so many people died, elderly people, vulnerable people died because of decisions made by the government's chief medical officer and the chief scientific officer.
Yeah, I was going to mention that actually, within the mainstream media, just to go back to the journalists, actually, we were talking about how they can you know, just select to choose one argument when they're writing stories for the paper. But I think everyone I work with, they've got incredible integrity. They work really hard, but there's just a lack of knowledge of these blind spots, which includes the you know, do not resuscitate orders in care homes, and how people on existing doctors' treatments from hospital had those withheld when the lockdown came in because doctors were no longer going to the care homes. Don't forget, care homes are basically large hospitals in themselves, where a lot of people there are waiting to die or are near death. So suddenly withholding, you know, treatments for them, doing do not resuscitate orders, having a skeleton staff, who, you know, there's in the Spectator, they were saying that, you know, staff, residents in there were dying of thirst, and you know, because they're in this COVID environment where doctors can give a diagnosis of COVID without a test, even according to the Coronavirus Act. You know, there's just been, it's been like a cauldron of like chaos that's allowed for the deaths to be seen to be spiking really highly because of COVID, when it could be the lockdown causing the death.
That's right. And the other thing, of course, is that because of the blocking of relatives, etc., visiting, you know, we've seen several occasions where people have been being very, very badly treated, that if their relatives knew the way that their elderly loved ones were being treated, they'd be absolutely mortified and would probably physically grab them and drag them out of the care home.
Yeah, that's very, very true. And I've got personal experience of that. Yeah, my mum sadly passed away, and she had various good nurses at the hospital and a couple of not very good ones. And the family was there. We were being proactive to make sure she had, you know, a good end of life. And it just, I don't even want to think about what some people have gone through in care homes, you know, with dementia. They're already fearful. And, you know, I visited my dad in a care home once, and they are horrendous places. You know, you hear screaming, and there's no nurses to go and see them, and you know, it's just awful. So you know, when you've got relatives there, there's a safety net to protect them, but without the relatives there, we need whistleblowers from care homes, and there are some, but not many.
Well, that's right. And also the medical profession have been told by certainly all of the hospital trusts, the NHS trusts that I've managed to get solid information from, have been telling their staff, never speak to a journalist. If you do, it's a sackable offence. That's pretty shocking, Henry.
Yeah. I mean, I know some journalists who've, you know, got like friends in the medical profession, and you know, that these friends in the medical profession are towing the party line, saying, yeah, it's a real serious thing, and lockdown is necessary. And you know, of course, they would say that because their jobs depend on it. And it's also quite difficult for journalists like me and Ben. You know, I would argue that we're being quite brave stepping up here, setting up this group. Because, you know, like any employee, there's in your contract, you cannot go around criticising the company you work for. And, you know, I do want to stress that the company that me and Ben work for, JPI Media, they have been doing their best. And, you know, like newspaper groups in general, we've been suffering with decades with chronic understaffing. So all the people around me, I can't fault them. They're doing a brilliant job. It's just I want to use this group, and me and Ben want to use this group to raise awareness with our colleagues that there is a counter argument.
Yeah, well, there's certainly. Okay, so I'm going to put you on the spot now, Ben, take a step back from all of this. What's really going on? You know, because surely there must be some other agenda if there are attempts to muzzle the press and steer the government to certain decisions. I mean, you know, if the pharmaceutical industry actually makes more money, the more people are sick. This is quite a worrying prospect, you know. So anyway, what do you think? What's the bigger agenda?
I think the bigger agenda is control. I think the ultimate aim is for global governments to control us as citizens. They've completely exaggerated the threat of this virus. They've had completely disproportionate restrictions. And yet the agenda is a global agenda by global governments to try and control us and to suppress us and turn us into some kind of big fascist state. And that's the kind of thing that I'm seeing, and it's extremely worrying.
It is worrying, isn't it, Henry? Because we've seen in the past that when big corporations start funding political parties to mould society for their own benefit, and then they start to basically control the government, control the regulation of various industries, in this case, healthcare, you know, capture basically the regulators, and so that the regulation isn't really happening because it's controlled by the industry itself. We've seen actually the same going on with the telecoms industry and 5G, that the ICNIRP, which is the regulator, two MEPs 2 months ago came out with a report saying basically that the regulator of 5G is controlled by the 5G industry, so there isn't really any regulation of it. But what would you say about the pandemic and the response to it? If you take a step back from it, what's the real agenda?
I would say it's control, definitely. Exactly, I echo completely what Ben's just said. It's just about controlling citizens and the freedoms that we're willingly handing, you know, to the governments will not be given back unless we have legacy media, if you like, that will hold authority to account. And we better start doing it soon.
I mean, it's almost with the masks, it's almost like China. I mean, certainly most, you know, a lot of, and it was a, became a norm, didn't it, in many Oriental countries, particularly around Beijing, to do with pollution. But now it seems that the mask is some sort of sign of compliance to control. Are we becoming a bit like China?
I would say so, yeah. I don't know what Ben thinks on that, but yeah, when I walk around the supermarkets, I do see, I don't wear a mask. I've got asthma, but I wouldn't wear a mask anyway. And I can't even go to the dentist now because they insisted that I had my temperature taken. So I'm not willing to bend the knee now because I'm not willing to, I'm drawing the line.
I mean, hang on, Henry. That's surely sensible. If you've got a high temperature, you probably shouldn't be in there.
Well, I disagree because the government has its own website, and I had one of its pages shared with me that a high temperature is no indication that you've got COVID or not. That shouldn't be relied on as a test to see if you've got COVID or not. So it's just part of the overall staging of compliance. You know, it's like a totalitarian tiptoe, if you like. So for now, it's okay, just wear the mask. Well, let's go back to March, actually. It's just stay in your houses for 2 weeks while we flatten the curve. Yeah. But as it transpired, the hospitals were, you know, like ghost ships anyway, from numerous sources. Of course, people wouldn't willingly officially go on the record saying that because they'd be, relieved. So as you were saying, it's a sackable offence to go against the script. And then after that, it's okay. Well, now the World Health Organization is saying it's airborne and we really should be wearing masks. Oh, okay, well, now you should really be having your temperature taken. Oh, well, you really now should be having your vaccination. You know, it's just going to go on. And, when we have this compulsory vaccinations coming out, I'm fairly sure they will do. It won't be compulsory in terms of being held down by a military person injected. You'll just be told there's various things you can't do. And those various things could even mean getting a job or going into an office. So I think
you've suddenly done there is reminded me of China, where you can't travel if you've got a low social credit score. You put your credit card in to the machine to buy a train ticket and it just spits it out and it says your credit card score doesn't allow you to travel.
Yeah, I've seen the documentaries on that, and that's where we're going with the, you know, sort of the health passports, and I think in Ireland they're introducing a sort of traffic light system where it's just in terms of testing, not even the of course we've not got the vaccine yet, so if you've been tested and they've been cleared, then you can do certain things. But if you're in the amber, then you need to have another test. And if you're red, then you've not been tested, and we don't know if you're safe or not. So that's another thing I'm refusing to. I won't be accepting any test. And even if that means I get put in jail for 2 weeks or whatever, I'm just not
going to. Okay, well, look, Ben, is there any light at the end of the tunnel? Do you see that there is sort of any little sparks of resistance to these measures?
I'd like to think so, because obviously at first Boris Johnson was saying we'd never enough be back to normal by July. Then he was saying December. Now he's saying by the end of next year that social distancing restrictions might be done with. But it just seems to be going on and on and on. We're talking about this cherished vaccine that's going to solve everything. And it just seems to be going on and on. So at the moment, I really can't see any light at the end of the tunnel. I'm wanting to, but I just can't see any way out of this. We've already been told that the restrictions could be going on for 6 more months until March. And then I've read something that even when we get a vaccine, we could still be under restrictions. So just how long is this going to go on?
I suppose one positive thing I could say is that even though the TV is telling us that the police are very strict about all this kind of thing, when you actually speak to individual officers, they don't really seem to be very interested in enforcing these restrictions, and they're much more interested in carrying on doing their job and actually catching criminals. But anyway, what about you, Henry? Any light at the end of the tunnel?
Yeah, I think there is light at the end of the tunnel. You've described the sort of the control network that we're under, with sort of the government being able to manipulate the press and the press being able to manipulate the public. And for me, it's been forever thus. So we just have to operate within that environment, have strong voices out there questioning what's going on, and, you know, persuade public opinion that way. And it may come to a point where we have a split, a bit like with Brexit. Well, those who are pro-vax, and then there's going to be those who just want to have informed consent. And I would argue the pro-vaxxers are the ignorant ones, because they'll accept a vaccine without doing the research. In fact, when I have debates about vaccines, it tends to be the people who agree with me have done research, and those who disagree with me quite vehemently have not done any research on it. So it's just about sharing information. That's where my positivity is coming from.
Yeah, good. Well, there's somebody who has done a lot of research on it is a woman called Julie Beale, who I interviewed recently. And she has actually uncovered, I think, what I think is the big scandal, which is the gene editing qualities of these new vaccines. She actually says that they shouldn't be called vaccines because they're not based on any sort of normal traditional pathogen, which vaccines always have been in the past. These new types of vaccines, she calls them the Ronavax, because they are there to edit your genes. They go into your cells and they snip various bits of your DNA and that sort of thing. And the other thing that she mentioned, which is, it's fascinating. Did you know that these gene editing so-called vaccines, what she calls the Ronavax, or the Rona scam, she uses the word, have been actually in development for over 30 years, but they've never been able to get any approval for them. And they believe that is, when I say they, Big Pharma, these big pharmaceutical companies, that this is going to be sort of a little hump for them to get over so that they can now get these vaccines that the Ronavaxes, the gene editing ones, approved, whereas before they might not have done so. But I mean, there is a lot of awareness out there. I think, I mean, for me, the most positive thing has been seeing a lot of young people doing things like having raves, where they have made a conscious decision that they want to catch whatever this is. They want to get together because they believe that, and the government studies will actually bear them out, that not a single young person has actually died of COVID-19, not one in the UK. Some have died, obviously, with pre-existing conditions. And so it is quite a reasonable argument to say that we should not have closed schools down for 6 months. So kids have been deprived of their education, arguably, for 6 months for nothing. And I don't think that the young people are going to take this lying down. I think that there's a, you know, certainly an awareness amongst them of a sort of globalist plan. The idea that the government is not actually there as a benevolent thing to help you, and that there are all sorts of problems with our democracy. Youngsters have got that, I think. And that for me is one of the big pluses. Anyway, so Ben Butler and Henry Widdes, thanks very much for joining us. Maybe, Henry, you could just say again what is the name of your group in case any journalists listening are interested in getting in touch.
Yeah, well, it's called Hold Authority to Account. So we haven't got a website or anything. We're just like sort of a WhatsApp group, just sharing stories, really, about our experiences of covering COVID.
How do people get in touch with you?
Well, they could drop me an email. It's henrywiddes@gmail.com. I'll spell that. So Henry, normal spelling, and then Widdes is Whiskey Indigo Delta Delta Alpha Sierra. And then, yeah, at gmail.com. And then if they just email me, give the sort of, you know, job title. I mean, they don't have to, we don't sort of say who's working where on the group. We just, you know, just the rule is that we're journalists, and it could be their phone number, and then I can just add them. And it's Ben's also a moderator on the group, so he can add people as well. So far, we've got a dozen members. We only set it up last week, and yeah, we've got 12 members, hoping to get to maybe 50 by Christmas.
Okay. We'll finish with another song, and that is called COVID-19, the musical. And I hope you're going to dance along. It's by a group called Frankie Goes to Nowhere. Ben Butler and Henry Widdes, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Every day, 19. Every day, 19.
Snitches get rewards. We want to thank you for turning folks in and making sure we are all safe.
7 billion people.